Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 436. In this episode, Scott talks with Dilbert creator Scott Adams about his new startup, Calendar Tree.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I am chatting with Scott Adams. He's the creator of the Dilbert comic strip and now has a new startup called Calendar Tree. Thanks for chatting with me today, sir.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the things about Dilbert that's so interesting is how it resonates with reality. And we always kind of assumed that you were working in a startup pretty much for the last 20 years. How did you keep the voice so authentic? Were you working with office people at the time?
Well, it's a combination of things. So the first, I guess, 8 years of my career, I actually had a day job. So I've been pulling from those memories, plus a lot of people email me and say, can you please embarrass my boss? He desperately needs it. And I'm always happy to help. And then more recently, I've always had a variety of side businesses. I owned restaurants for a while. I started a food company. I've tried a different variety of software related things. And now doing the Calendar Tree startup, I'm kind of always in the business world. You know, I'm still having those same business meetings, and I'm still trying to set objectives and do all those things that I write about.
And are you the pointy-haired boss now?
Oh, I try to avoid having anything that looks like management authority because I'm pretty sure I'm terrible at it. It's really easy to make fun of people, you know, who do it wrong. But I honestly think that to be a really great manager, you've got to have at least some minimum level of evil in you because the whole point of managing, right, and leadership in general is getting people to do something that they didn't want to do on their own. So if it was simply a matter of informing them, then you wouldn't need a manager. So you need somebody to actually manipulate people to act against what they believe would have been their own best interest. Yeah, with some convoluted argument about how this will pay off in the future. So there's a little bit of evil in that I can't fully embrace. So I could never really be a good manager.
So it is manipulation. Good management is excellent manipulation.
Yeah, manipulation is one of those words that makes you think it's automatically bad. But in fact, we're all manipulating our environment for good or bad. It's what we do as humans. But certainly if you're a manager, you're trying to get people to do things differently than they were going to do on their own. And what they were going to do on their own was probably what they thought was good for them. So really, you are talking them into doing something that you hope they will believe is good for them in the long run, but really it's good for you and good for the company, probably.
So when you run your startup, are you the benevolent dictator? Like, let's all talk about it, we'll vote, and then I'll decide anyway?
No, we don't go that far. You know, my co-founder, Quinn Harker, and I, we make decisions together, but I was quite clear that I wanted him to be the CEO, partly because he has those skills, and partly because I'm terrible at it. So ultimately, he's the decision maker, but we also have equity holders from Australia, Blue Chili, who helped us get started. They did the tech, and they maintained a equity portion. So we've always got enough smart people to weigh in. And so far, we're all pretty data-driven people. So the best idea usually emerges. We haven't had too much in the way of disagreements.
Hmm. Are you doing a lot of like A-B testing to make sure things are correct? Or when you're using the data to drive the business, what kind of data are you collecting?
Oh, I just mean in terms of conversation over should we do A or should we do B. Mm. We're all pretty rational people, so we tend to drive that discussion toward, all right, has anybody tried A? How did that work out? You know, what are the odds that A would work compared to the odds of B? So we're just fairly rational people, and when you're all rational, things work out well. You know, the thing I write about in Dilbert is always that there's always the crazy person in the office, all right? You have to inject just one a-hole into an otherwise rational situation, and everything breaks down. Mm-hmm. But if you have three people in the room, and that's usually how many we have, you know, three or four, and you're all rational creatures who are working toward a, you know, a common solution, you really don't get a lot of disagreements as long as you're willing to look at the facts.
That is the goal. That is the goal. Unfortunately, though, a-hole driven development, or ADD, somehow seems to happen so often. And I have found sometimes when I'm convinced that everyone on my team is an a-hole, it's usually in fact that it's me.
Yes. Yeah, I know that feeling. I usually think it's me. I go to that first.
Yeah. So what does Calendar Tree do?
So Calendar Tree was developed as a solution to a very specific problem. And the problem is, and probably every adult who at least owns a smartphone has had this problem, which is you're involved in some club or organization, or maybe your kids are in a club or a team or an organization, and some organizer or coach sends you a list of all the games, meetings, and practices. And you've got this huge list that arrived in email. And now what are you going to do with it? Like, do you have to thumb type it into your phone so you have it on your calendar? Do you put it on the wall, but you're never in the room where it's hanging on the wall? Mm-hmm. So you got this problem. So what Calendar Tree does is let that organizer enter the series of events into Calendar Tree and then send that out as a link, either by email or it could be by, you know, Facebook posting or Twitter or LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And then anybody who gets the link can click on it, and whether they have Google Calendar or Apple or Outlook, they can add that entire series of events to their existing calendar with just a few keystrokes. So what we do is we let you keep your existing calendar that you're already happy with, it's already doing what you want, and just easily add large incoming series of events that you're interested in.
So that it's not a second calendar, they are the events themselves that kind of come into your calendar you're already using?
Yeah, unfortunately, we probably made a mistake naming the company because our name is Calendar Tree, but we were thinking more about the tree part, the connection part, than we were thinking about the calendar. So we're not a calendar. We're a way to easily get large blocks of event stuff onto your calendar, no matter what kind you have. Mm. Now, secondarily, once we've connected to your calendar, once you've given us permission to do that and add it, mm-hmm. then when the organizer has a change to the schedule, that change will flow automatically to your calendar with an email notification that just says, this change happened, it's already on your calendar.
Ah, okay. So I just recently joined our HOA, which is both good and bad. And so I'm the guy in the HOA. And one of the things we've been struggling with is trying to figure out how we're going to get everyone to know when the events are. We've got, you know, public meetings, and we have to, there's legal rules for us to say we're having a meeting and everyone knows where it is. I could put a year's worth of the HOA in Calendar Tree and people
absolutely.
Could subscribe to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in that specific example, you might have trouble getting people to care about the HOA meetings. So in those cases, that might be a better case where people do want maybe a separate calendar, or if they need it, they can go to it. Where Calendar Tree really sparkles is if it's your kid's soccer team and mom has the schedule, but dad doesn't. Wouldn't it be great if everybody had it, including the kid on their own phone? And maybe grandma wants to see the schedule too. You know, why can't grandma come to the home games? So when you talk about stuff that you know you want every one of those items on your calendar, and there's not one thing on there that you don't really care about, that's where we're helpful. HOA, your real problem is getting people to care.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's not, you know, the calendar isn't your biggest problem.
It's interesting. So I just got an email yesterday from my kids' community school, which we all do care about, and it was a PDF of the year's events that looked like it had been. Yeah, exactly. It was quite, God bless him for trying, but it was rather cobbled together. And then the best part, you're going to like this, the day after was the apology for the incorrect PDF. Apparently, all of the dates had been shifted over by one, and Friday was actually a Thursday, so they had redone the entire PDF and sent it out to us again.
Right. Now, multiply that by every organization that you're in, every organization that your family members are in, because you kind of usually need to keep track of that, too. Mm-hmm. And every one of them is a mess. Mm-hmm. And right now, Calendar Tree is the only thing that solves that problem.
Okay. So then it looks like it's free. The current pricing is it's free for 50 calendar connections. So that would be people that are connected to that calendar?
Yeah. So if you're a small organization, it's free. And once you get to large organizations who find it useful, I mean, if you have more than 50 people connected to your calendar, that probably has a real business value to you.
And indeed.
For a few bucks a year, you'd be happy to use that.
Mm-hmm. So you said that you'd started a number of companies before, whether it be software or you said you also some restaurants. Is this just something where writing a cartoon or two a day is just too challenging and you have to challenge yourself even more? I just assumed that when you're a famous cartoonist, you write your cartoon and you go to the beach.
Yeah, a lot of people think that. Well, here's the complicated answer to that. Number one, I don't really like the beach. I don't even like vacation. I don't like the feeling of sitting around being useless. You know, I was raised by parents who said, you know, whatever you do, just be useful. You know, add something. And I'm terribly uncomfortable doing nothing. Mm-hmm. I can do it for a day. I can do it for maybe 3 days, but you know, vacations don't work for me. So I'm not big on free time. All right. That's the first thing. And secondly, it's very synergistic. I hate to use that word since I mock it. But in order to be a good cartoonist or a good writer, you have to have another part of your life, which is filling you with ideas. It's giving you the complexity and the diversity of thought that you're not going to get sitting in a room staring at your computer. So I need to get out and mix it up with the real world. But beyond that, especially with Calendar Tree, sometimes you see a problem and you say, all right, no one's going to fix that. Mm-hmm. But I could. I could fix that problem. And it's a problem that's as close to universal as a problem could be, which is how do I get this stuff on my calendar so I know where to be? Mm-hmm. It's not going away. It's not getting less by itself. Somebody had to fix it. And so we started by looking around to see who had already done it. That was our first choice. The first choice was just use someone else's thing, but it didn't exist. Now, it turns out it was really hard. It was hard to build this thing. It took 2 years to get it right. And a lot of that had to do with tweaking the interface until people could understand this thing, which wasn't like things they had used before. Mm-hmm. How do you walk them through it in a way that, you know, the average mind follows in the same, you know, sequence of learning. Mm-hmm. So we got that, and we hope we can solve this fairly large problem. And we've got a number of smaller features that we're looking to add to this set of solutions that would be likewise useful in slightly different time-related, scheduling-related fields.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had done some work as a programmer. You'd done all sorts of different things. But from hearing you kind of light up talking about this, it sounds like you may be a user experience researcher and looking at different, A/B testing and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, I love that stuff because I love the the connection between the technology and the, you know, the human cognitive, you know, amazing things that you can never stop learning. Mm-hmm. It's sort of this infinite well of knowledge that you start falling down and you think, well, I must be halfway down now, and you're not. You haven't even touched it. Mm-hmm. I used to work in a group that did interface testing at the phone company. Mm-hmm. So I kind of got immersed in that world and started to love it. But I'm more than that, I'm actually a kind of a business model nerd. Hmm. If you ask me what's my favorite thing to think about and talk about, it would be how could I turn something into a business that had never been a business before? My background is not art. I think most people know that when they look at my comic. My background is economics. I have a degree in economics. I have an MBA from Berkeley. So most of my, you know, core talent is around business and how to make something work. And in fact, it's probably at least half of the reason that Dilbert broke out from a crowded field of comics that were in many cases better than mine. But I had enough business experience that I could make things happen that weren't happening for other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of economics and business, you wrote a book, not a cartoon compilation book, but a book more about business and your experience in business called How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. Did you pull from those aspects of your background?
Yeah, that book was sort of a public service sort of thing. Obviously, I wanted to be commercially successful because that gets it to the most people and creates the most good. But the idea was, you know, I've learned a number of things because I've been involved in so many different types of businesses and everything from, you know, art to technology to, you know, serious business stuff. And I thought I wanted to see if I could capture that. Mm-hmm. Now, what's unique about my situation is that probably my one world-class skill, if I could say that, is that I'm pretty good at simplifying things. And that comes from probably a little bit of upbringing, but a lot of practice being a cartoonist and taking complicated things and putting them in three sentences every day. So I thought, well, when I was 20, I really didn't have a mentor. I didn't have anybody who could give me the basic model of success. You know, what's the basic idea? I know I'm going to tailor it myself. So my book doesn't try to tell people, do it this way. What I say instead is, there are a lot of people doing a lot of different things. Some of them are working. They're not all going to be the thing that works for you. But here's what I did, and try to explain it as clearly as possible so that somebody reading the book can say, okay, I may not want to use all of this, but let me compare it to what I'm doing now. Let me compare it to what other people are telling me. Which one makes more sense? And by the way, if I can test one against the other, you know, do it this way for a while. How does it work? Do it this way for a while. Why not? So it's a little bit of here's more stuff to think about. Here's more stuff to test. It looks like it worked for me, but you have to acknowledge that luck is a giant factor in all of this stuff. And I address that fairly directly by talking about the obvious, which is if you do 10 things, you've created a situation where luck can find you a little more readily than if you did one thing and out.
Hmm. I've had conversations with people at startup conferences and, you know, places where people are doing a side gig or some kind of moonlighting, and they always seem to have one idea that they're doing on the side that they're throwing their entire life into. And I've always said, like, I see what you're doing here, but you're going to be crushed when that doesn't work out. So I always try to have three or four little ideas that are going to create passive income that are going to be, you know, if one of them falls apart, it's not going to be a huge deal. Like, if you were going to start a consulting company, you would not want to have one client.
Right.
You want to mix it up.
Right. You want diversity in all things. I mean, there aren't too many situations where diversity isn't a good thing. You know, diversifying your portfolio of whatever. And adding on to what you just said, history has shown that there's literally no one smart enough to predict what's going to work. All right. That person hasn't been born yet who can look at an idea in its infancy and say, yeah, that thing is going to go from a good idea to a working business model to no real competition to a monopoly someday. Hmm. Nobody can do that. What people can do is say, okay, you didn't do anything so stupid it's going to kill you. All right. That it looks good so far. And then you did three of them. So that's smarter. You've increased your odds. The other thing I learned, and I wrote about this in the book you mentioned, How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, is that often you can identify something that's going to go big by its X factor, but that thing, you can't really build it in. Like, you can't say, I want to build some X factor into this thing. It's something you see after the fact a little bit, you know, once it's already kind of on its way. But you can detect that early by how much excitement a small number of people have for it, right? As opposed to a large group of people all say, that's pretty good, then you have nothing, all right? Because I've seen that over and over again. If a lot of people say, yeah, that's a good idea, that's pretty good, you got nothing. But if 90% of the people say, and this applied to Dilbert in the first few years, 90% of the people say, that's really awful. That's poorly drawn, poorly written. It doesn't apply to me whatsoever. But here's the important part. 10% look at that and they say, I'm going to have to cut this out. I'm going to form my own book of Dilbert comics based on strips I have selected. I like them so much. I'm going to send them to my friends. I'm going to write to the author. This works for me. This is touching something. Then you have something that you probably can't stop unless you do something stupid. All right. So then it's going to grow. So, that's what I look for. I look for you throw it out there and you see, did anybody get excited?
See, while you were saying that, I just got a little tear in my eye because I was thinking about the TV show Firefly, which yes. is exactly what you just said. Like, you know, 10% of us are like, we worship at the altar of Firefly, and everyone's like, I think it's not really that interesting. But they still canceled it, the bastards.
But they made a movie.
They did make a movie, which I watched. I rewatched it.
Which I watched and enjoyed it a lot.
Very, very much. Very, very much.
Yeah, that, in a way, I guess that might be, one of the exceptions because, that certainly had, the original Star Trek got poor ratings.
Oh, yeah. Really?
But it had the X Factor so much so that, it spawned Trekkies.
Yeah. I just picked up a copy of the DVD special edition of The Search for Spock over at a garage sale for $2 by someone who did not appreciate it. Changing gears a little bit, I noticed that you had an issue with your hands. And I've written up extensively on the programmer's hands and have had surgery on my right hand for trigger finger and a number of tendon issues where I've been unable to work because of my hand. What happened to your hand?
So what happened was that when I drew, my pinky finger would involuntarily spasm. And we thought at first it was just some damage in the hand, some kind of carpal tunnel. But by weird coincidence, the expert, the world expert probably in this condition that I had, lived in my town. And he was part of the Kaiser HMO that I used. So I got referred to him and he identified it as a focal dystonia, which is actually based in the brain.
Uh-oh.
And one of the ways you can confirm this is that when I drew left-handed, which I could do a little bit, I'm mildly ambidextrous, as soon as my left hand hit the page, my right hand pinky would spasm with no pen in it. So that's how you know it's brain and not hand. So when I went to him and I said, here's my problem. He diagnosed me and I said, what's the fix? What's the cure? He says, surgery, I'll get it. I have to have this because I gotta be able to draw. Mm-hmm. And he said, there isn't any. The fix is you change careers. But if you'd like, you can be part of a group of people who are trying different things. And if one of them works, a little bit of A-B testing, I guess. If one of them works, you'll have something. Would you like to be part of that? So I said, yes. So I tried biofeedback. I tried, the manipulations of the hands and various practices and stuff. And I wasn't getting any real results. But then I tried this. I noticed that when I touched my pen to paper, it would be just a little delay before the pinky would spasm. Mm-hmm. So during my business meetings, I was still working my day job then. I'd sit at the meeting and below the table where nobody could watch, I would just do this. I would just tap my pen to paper and then remove it before the spasm. Mm-hmm. Now, I reasoned that if this was a brain problem, it could be reprogrammable. And so eventually I got that I could hold it there for a second and before it would spasm. And once I got that up to like 5 seconds, it just reprogrammed and it went away. And I believe I was told I'm in the literature under, not with my own name, as the first case of a reversal. Now, the trick with that is that if I continue drawing on paper with the same regularity and amount of work, it would come back. And I felt it start to come back a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I moved, when it started to come back the last time, I felt a little twinge of it. I moved to the Wacom. Mm-hmm. Which is what I use now. So I draw directly on the computer screen. Mm-hmm. I reasoned that if my brain is where this is starting, that even though I'm using the same motion with a stylus that is just like a pen, that it would feel different enough that it wouldn't activate it because it was just a slightly sort of a cousin to the routine. It wasn't close enough. And that's exactly what happens. So I can draw all day on the computer and it doesn't activate the pinky. If I write more than 10 checks in a row, the pinky starts to get a little twinge.
That's amazing. I've been typing for so many years. I've been typing basically, you know, full time as a job for 25 years. I cannot write. I cannot stand to write, like signing checks and writing. Oh. It's just my hands cripple up.
Yeah, I have that problem plus the mental thing, which is if you don't write, you kind of forget how. So, you know, I'll be writing something and I'll think, I don't think that's even a letter. I don't even know what that is.
I was trying to teach my six-year-old cursive because he thinks it's a foreign language. And I've completely lost cursive. Like, I don't even know what a cursive R looks like. It's just a line on the way to another letter. And he's like, he actually questioned my ability at cursive. My six-year-old was like, is this really a thing? Are you sure this is how people write?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you should be teaching him HTML5 or something instead. I don't know.
Frankly, I really need to. It's a problem. So in your day, how much time do you spend drawing? How much time do you spend at Calendar Tree? And is this like a startup where you have an office, or do you just hang out at your kitchen table?
So right now we're dispersed. We've got some folks in Australia. My founder and I are in the same town, and we have a CTO now, and he's a driving distance away. So we meet at my house in my garage, which I have outfitted as a proper garage office.
How very Jobsian of you.
Very Jobsian. I thought the vibe of it being in an actual garage would somehow help. And it's amazing how it does. There's something about the, you know, stick to business nature of a garage that does feel right. I actually do feel more productive out there.
Yeah, it is. It's funny. I put a treadmill desk together in the garage. And when I open the big double doors and I'm on the treadmill desk and I'm deleting email, like a champ, cause that's my job. It just has a feeling of like, I'm going places as I am not going anywhere. I'm sitting here doing my little treadmill and deleting email. I feel like, you know, I'm in my garage and I'm getting things done and taking care of business. It is somehow more satisfying than a big mahogany home office.
And, you know, if I may, say something that it reminded me of, you've probably seen some research that says if you're in a cafe with cafe background noise, you're actually more creative than if it had been silent. Likewise, if you take a shower, you're more creative. And if you take a walk, you're more creative. And all these things have been pretty well demonstrated. Now, a walk and a shower and a cafe have nothing in common except a certain type of distraction that you can compartmentalize. Like you can walk while forgetting you're walking, you shower while forgetting you're showering. Cafe, you block out the background noises after a while. So there's something about a creative distraction that somehow helps the you know, generation of new ideas.
Interesting.
So I think you're going to find your treadmill desk is giving you more than exercise.
I like that. I wonder if it's blocking out all of the crushing self-doubt.
No, you need that. Don't lose that. That's the only thing that gets us up in the morning.
Have you ever found yourself in your office, not in a cafe, not walking, not in the shower, saying, I have to get a strip out today, and if I don't, I'm going to die, and I have nothing?
So, yes. And when I started this, I was doing my day job where I'd have to leave for the office at like 6:30 in the morning. So from, you know, 4 to 4:30 in the morning until then, I had to do my work, and I had to do one every day or else there would be a blank spot in the newspaper. So what I discovered was, and this was the great freeing discovery of my life, probably the single most useful thing I ever learned, which is that sometimes I'd have this great idea and I'd have the whole hour and a half to develop it. And sometimes I'd have only 10 minutes left and nothing, but I'd say, okay, just do something bad. You know, you don't have the option of nothing. So if all you can think of is the bad idea, do that bad idea. What happened was, and the great, you know, realization is that the readers would judge the bad version as highly as the good version, sometimes better. In fact, there was no correlation between what I thought was a home run and what the audience thought was a good comic. I just couldn't judge. Now, I'd seen a hint of that when I first tried to submit my comics for publication. When I tried to become a syndicated cartoonist, I put together 50 sample Dilbert comics, I called all my friends over and I said individually, so they wouldn't be influenced by each other, sort these into the good ones and the bad ones, so I only send out my good ones. And a number of friends did that, and there was no correlation. There was no way I could pick the better ones that were more likely to be picked. Just no correlation. So I sent them all in, and Dilbert got picked up. But one thing you learn is that you're just not good at judging what other people are going to like. You have to kind of put something out there, conform to some rules of, you know, it has to be this type of thing and fit this space. But beyond that, you're just guessing.
Very cool. Well, folks can check out the first 50 Dilbert comics at dilbert.com/first_50. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and go up to calendartree.com and you can click on Get Started Now and sign up. Free trial, 50 calendar connections. Very, very cool. Thank you so much, Scott Adams, for chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me. This is fun.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.